I feel like in the past I've had coaches or people tell me like, oh, you can't do this in a marathon. It's too long to focus on the splits. You got to turn it off. You got to turn your brain off. You can't think about this. To put it simple, I just didn't listen to those things. I just did what I felt like was the best thing for me. And I'm proud of that because like I felt like the first few marathons I was trying to be what other people had told me marathoners are. I was like, that's not how I work. I'm a very, like I have a ton of energy and focus that I can put on things. Like I'm a detail oriented guy. I actually became more relaxed the more I was into the information that was being brought to me. And every good split was like a building block, right? That happened and let myself just totally dial into everything around me. I was paying attention to the guys in my group. I was paying attention to the pacer. I was paying attention to when the next fueling station was. I was like hyper focused, and that's kind of against the grain of like what a lot of people preach on how you should be for 2 hours of racing, but it just felt more natural for me to be that way.
Hey guys, welcome to the Run Free podcast, where we talk about training using our holistic five principles. These are the principles we use every day in our training programs. At Run Free Training, we offer online coaching programs where you get a personal coach, you get access to our nutritionist, Joe Butler, the form analysis with our 1% coach, Mitchell Robertson, you get access to our online e-course that teaches you about each of the holistic five principles. Coaching packages are only $199.99. with a 6-month commitment. You can sign up for coaching by creating a profile in our athlete portal. Find the link in our podcast description or head on over to runfreetraining.com. DM us on Instagram or sign up for a free consultation on the website if you have more questions about the next step.
All right, Rory, welcome to the Run Free podcast. Thanks for coming on, man. So first off, big PR in Seville. Tell us a little bit about that race and what you've been up to since then.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I don't know what took so long for you to have me on. Just kidding. No, Seville was sweet. Obviously, we're a little over a month post-race now, so we've kind of gone through the stages of, you know, realizing, hey, I just had a big breakthrough race, ran a big personal best that opened a door for a likely Olympic berth here. And now I'm back into the swing of training and getting my butt kicked by some fit 5K, 10K specialists here in Flagstaff, Aaron and Bia in the training group. So I'm just having fun getting back into my own swing of things. And just trying to get everything ready and lined up for a push to Paris later this summer.
Nice. Yeah, so, I mean, for you guys that don't know, got the standard, which was 208.10, right? And we all, like each country had its own way of qualifying for the Olympics. So where's the whole qualification process at for you guys in Canada?
Yeah, so it's pretty basic and simple. The fastest three are most likely to be selected. And right now I'm number two, and I'm one of only two Canadians that have the standards. So things are looking good, but with about a month left in the qualifying window, there's always a chance that somebody could bump me out and I'd have to, you know, rest easy knowing that I did my job and people were more deserving than I. But as of right now, I'm sitting number two on the three-man possibility team. But yeah, that's where it is. It's just basically the three fastest Canadians will be selected for the Paris Games. And right now I'm number two.
Nice, man. That's pretty exciting stuff. So where's your competition at? Like, is anybody knocking on that door?
Yeah, so Ben Preisner is probably the most likely threat. And he ran 208.58 in February in BEPA 02, which is a Japanese marathon. So he'd have to run a minute personal best 2 months after his previous personal best that he just ran. So that's a tough task, but hey, nothing's impossible if you nail it right, you know? So he's probably the number one threat. The number two guy just announced that he's injured and not going to run a spring marathon. So unfortunate for him, he probably won't give it a fair shake. And then there's one more guy that has run 210 that is doing Boston. So Boston can't run the time there because it's not a record eligible course. But if he were to come top five at Boston, that's the equivalent to a standard because it's a platinum label race. So he's got a, that's a kind of even a more daunting task to try to be top five at the Boston Marathon, but that's what he'd have to do.
Yeah. I haven't even seen the start list for Boston this year. How's it looking?
Sarah Hall's in it, so
I feel like that's all that matters.
yeah. I haven't looked at the start list either, but it's
Yeah.
Boston. I mean, it's always great.
Yeah. And I'm sure, I mean, there's always a bunch of guys in that range anyways too, where top five getting like that's what usually more like in the 207-ish range, I think.
Yeah, it depends on weather. It's bo you know, with Boston,
Yeah.
it can be anything, but unless we have like a was that 2018 year where Desland didn't won, where the weather's atrocious, usually it takes a heroic effort to be, and that was heroic too in its own right, but a different type of heroic effort to get top five.
I mean, that would be funny if like that guy runs like 215 but gets top five and you're like, what?
Yeah, I don't know what Athletics Canada will do in that circumstance, but I'm not losing sleep thinking about it either,
Yeah.
so.
I mean, I think like what you gotta just be stoked about hitting, you know, big PR. I mean, hitting that standard, like I imagine you guys were on that track, right? I imagine that the training was geared towards trying to hit the standard, correct?
Yeah, Ryan can jump in here and say what he
Yeah.
thought. Maybe.
Ryan
Probably
itch.
mid
Yeah,
quesadilla.
Ryan's snacking down, which is usual. But I think it's funny because Ryan, and one of the things I was thinking about is I think Ryan always seems to have this estimation of what his athletes are capable that maybe is more so than what they think they're capable of, right? So I thought that was just such a cool thing where I was like, I bet Ryan knew that Rory could do this, and then to actually have it happen is, you know, and that's can be a rare thing in running to actually nail the day that we maybe thought was possible. So, Ryan, what were your expectations, or what was your thoughts for Rory's race before?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's fairly difficult to target a time. You know what I mean? It's like I'm usually just looking at like what's the next step, you know? And you might be like working backwards. I mean, obviously we're going for the time, right? It's like the goal is to make the Olympic team. It's most athletes' goal this year. But usually like the emphasis is on just taking the next step. And then on Rory being able to absorb the training load well, which is, you know, that's largely up to him and his ability to recover well. And Rory's always been really good at recovering and really dialed in when it comes to things like sleep and taking care of his body, getting massage, body work, all that stuff that plays nutrition, all the stuff that plays into recovery. Rory's always been on top of that stuff, you know? So, you know, as we know, running is not just the training, it's more the lifestyle. If you can't absorb the training load, it doesn't matter what you're doing for your training, it's not going to work. So Rory's always been able to recover well, and you know, he's been working towards just running faster, I think, every single buildup. And you know, this was a special opportunity for him to get the time that we kind of knew he could do. But you know, I knew it was going to be tight. And I think Rory knew it was gonna be tight too. I remember he was talking to me before he left for his trip. He's like, "Do you think I can run this?" And I was like, "Yeah, I think you can run it, but it's gonna be tight, you know." And I was like, "I think our mentality just needs to be get to 20 miles and just take it 1 mile at a time from there, you know." And we did have some like backup options to where if it didn't work out and he'd say just missed it, you know, we could swing again at it. Marathons like a month or 2 months later. Obviously you don't want to have to do that, but I knew that if he could get close enough, you know, he's gonna have a really great shot at getting it. But you never know, you know, everything's got to come together in the marathon. The conditions got to be right, the pacing's got to be right, the body's got to be feeling right, and you got to be in the right headspace. And I think Rory did a really good job of getting himself mentally and emotionally in a really good spot and in a position to go after it. And then he did an excellent job of just executing. So it was cool to see it kind of all come together for him.
Yeah, I mean, man, because what were you were like 9 seconds below the standard, right? So I mean, you were right on it.
Yeah, nine seconds in a marathon does not. You know,
Oh.
that can be gone in a second. Like it can be gone just like that. One wrong step, one bad mile, like you can lose that time so easily in a marathon.
Yeah, I mean, I think of like the mental, I don't, and I'll be curious to kind of get to run down where you were at mentally during the race, but I think of like that can be a really mentally challenging thing to be so close to the goal, right? Where it's like you're constantly checked in, you feel like it's possible, but like you don't have any movement backwards, right? Like you don't have any space or any cushion to potentially, like you said, have a bad mile or have, and like at that pace, it's like you can't just drop like a 4:40 last mile, or typically, right? Like you don't see these like amazing last cl mile closes that allow you to get a lot of time back. It's like you gotta start chipping away at it. So I think
Yeah.
Jay had said this to me that you didn't know that you were like gonna get it until like it was there, right? Like 400 meters to go or something.
Yeah. So with at 41K, so like 1195 meters to go, whatever it is, I looked at my watch and I think I needed to run 340 for the last basically 1200 meters, right? And I was like, okay, that's like the pace I've been running, but I actually didn't know where my legs were at and like what my last few splits had been. So I had no idea if like that was the pace I was moving or if I had to pick it up. So my like idea was like, you got to pick it up because you don't want to leave it up to chance, right? So kind of really gradually doing something that Ryan's had me do a couple times in long thresholds, which is kind of go through your gears every 400 meters. So I went from 1195 to like 800 to go. I kind of just stayed smooth, didn't really change too much. And then I kind of went to another spot, and then I went to another spot with 400 to go. But it wasn't until the way that Seville was is I turned this corner and I had about 250 meters to go, maybe 200, and I could see the clock and I looked at my watch knowing I had about 200 to go. And I was like, that's when I was like, oh my gosh, I can do it, but I've gotta go. Like I can't. Like there's that 10 second window when you're doing math at the end of a marathon feels like do or die. So I just went into absolute hip to ear, just sprint mode. And I wish I had my last 200 split because I feel like it was at least a lifetime best for the end of a marathon. I don't know if I'll ever move that quickly at the end of a marathon again because I was just scratching and clawing for every second.
That's crazy. So mentally throughout the race, are you like checking your splits constantly, or are you just like feeling that effort out, or are you just in a group that's running that pace? Paused on this. Right, I think you're back on. Thank you, pause.
Yep, I can hear you now. I don't know what happened there, so.
No worries. So during the
All
race,
right.
like are
W
you are
where were
you
we?
so during the race, are you like keeping like a close tracking on your watch? Are you just in a group? Like how are you managing the pacing strategy there? Slightly glitchy.
I don't know if it's here. I just got off my Wi-Fi. Hopefully that'll help. Okay. I'll repeat the question because I'm pretty sure I know what you were saying. You were asking me basically if I was checking my watch regularly throughout the race and how.
So this is something I've noticed with working out with you is you keep a pretty tight watch on
I
what the
mean,
splits are.
I would say I was keeping tabs. I was probably looking every time there was a marker on the road, just to kind of see, which in a European marathon is 42 times in the race, if not more. So I would say yes, but I would also say that I wasn't really doing much more than just making sure there was no huge outliers. I didn't want anything to like surprise me or be like way off. So if I saw like I knew I had to run like 302 Ks. So if I saw anything like 305, I was going to be like, okay, like, we gotta get going. Like we can't lose 3 seconds here. Like that was more so, it was more just observing it. And a lot of the times it was positive. Like I never had a K split that I checked that I was freaked out by. And later in the race, I stopped checking. as frequently, and I stopped being able to really grasp how fast I don't know why, like in my brain it just like stopped making sense to me. Like it's like this weird thing, like you get so deep into the race that like I can't remember a single split that I checked and absorbed after mile 20. Like it just felt like that was like when it just became like primal. And so up until 20, I was dialed in. And then the last 6 miles, I was probably way more just competing and feeling it out. And when I looked at my splits at the end, I was shocked to see that I had kind of kept the exact same like basic clip going through until like the very, very end where I picked it up, because I had no perception of pace at that point. Just legs were getting heavy.
Well, I think of like people in terms of managing the mental component of that, right? Of like managing how do I stay mentally checked in? Like, but what's the best strategy for me mentally during a marathon? For like what you were doing, which is riding a very specific line of needing to hit certain splits, of like how do you manage that and what's the best strategy? Like, is it keeping close tabs on it? Or is it like running by feel? So like how do you feel like you went about managing like the mental side of say pre-race and in race, like going after a really big goal, knowing it's possible or feeling like it's possible, right? But not yet like having achieved that, because obviously you did something really well there.
I don't know. I guess I just played to my strengths, and like I feel like in the past I've had coaches or people tell me like, "Oh, you can't do this in a marathon. It's too long to focus on the splits. You got to turn it off. You got to turn your brain off. You can't think about this." You know, like I've heard all these like things from other people's experiences that told me what I shouldn't do in a marathon. And to put it simple, I just didn't listen to those things. I just did what I felt like was the best thing for me. And I'm proud of that, because like I felt like the first few marathons, I was trying to be what other people had told me marathoners are, which is this like, go, like, turn your brain off, run the first 20 miles like a zombie, and like, then the race starts. I was like, that's not how I work. I'm a very, like, I have a ton of energy and focus that I can put on things. Like I'm a detail oriented guy, and I actually became more relaxed the more I was into the information that was being brought to me. And every good split was like a building block, right? So I just like totally focused on it and let that happen and let myself just totally dial into everything around me. I was paying attention to the guys in my group. I was paying attention to the pacer. I was paying attention to when the next fueling station was. I was like hyper focused. And that's kind of against the grain of like what a lot of people preach on how you should be for 2 hours of racing. But it just felt more natural for me to be that way. And it worked out this time. And I think I'll take that and apply it going forward, not to fight the natural self that I am. And I did the same thing in the days leading up, right? So I like to have fun. I like to stay loose. I like to, you know, I brought my family. There's other things like, again, people are going to tell you like, oh, you just got to be relaxed. You got to do nothing. You got to chill out. There's all these rules that people try to superimpose on you, and I just didn't follow any of the rules other than eat a lot of food and rest the 2 days before. But other than that, I was just myself all the way through. And I think that that's something that I'm proud of, and I realize now that there's plenty of different ways to execute and run a good marathon, and you just got to find what works for you.
Rory, real quick, if I could just interject. This I thought was an interesting part of your experience that you were telling me after your race about. I forget who it was that you're hanging out with all the time, and he was just talking about how easy it was to hit the standard, and he's talking about it all the time, and it kind of like normalized it for you a little bit, made something that seemed like super hard for you to do, because it was going to take a couple minute PR by you, which is a lot to chop off in the marathon, even though we know like at Worlds you could have run much faster than 2:10 if it wasn't a fartlek and the conditions were better and stuff. But maybe just talk a little bit about how like that time got kind of normalized for you through that experience with this guy that you're around a lot in those last couple of days, and then how you might be able to pull on that experience for, say, like future time trial situations when, we're trying to break 207, get under 206, and when we're looking to take the next step in terms of your time progression in the marathon.
Yeah, great point. And that was actually a big part of it as well, because obviously the whole build, knowing that the time goal was large, that was a big thing, like a cloud hanging over the build. And then I get to Spain, I see my friend who runs for Belgium that had just hit the standard in Berlin in the fall, and he's talking about running 206 and how it shouldn't be that hard to run 208, and like people with way less talent than me have done it. He's basically like, it feels like he's insulting me that I haven't done it yet. And I kind of take that a little bit personally, to be honest. Like it felt like he was like, man, if you can't run 208, you must be a, lack of better words, a baby or something. I'm trying to think of the most PC way to put this, but yeah, he just kind of like talked it down for me. And I think that's something that I realize sometimes we talk things up and put things on a pedestal and make them way bigger mountains than they are, when in reality, I just ran a 61 minute half marathon 5 weeks before the marathon, and I had kind of a less than ideal situation in that race. I was still kind of in the thick of it, building momentum towards the A goal, which was the marathon. Like, why can't I run 3 minutes slower through half marathon and feel so good? Like, so I just kind of told myself, you're going to feel great. Like, you can run 64 minutes in a half marathon, no problem. And then I started telling myself, you can run 208 pace for 20 miles, no problem. Like, then it's just like a 6 mile race. And that was kind of how Ryan wrote it on the training, our little training sheet, like pre-race thing is 20 miles at 208 pace and then 6 by 1 mile all out, no rest.
I like that. Yeah, Ryan does a lot of creative stuff like that. Which Ryan, do you try to do that? Because I think of like it's interesting that it happened in such close proximity to the race, but still like had a beneficial effect. So I would think that that's helpful to do within training too, right? Where you normalize those paces so you can maybe train more effective or maybe be like more relaxed in your training too, right? So Ryan, what's your thought process on that? Like normalizing stuff for like normalizing new paces for athletes in training.
Yeah, one thing that I've been kind of playing with and with Rory a little bit is, instead of running, say, like, 15 mile threshold is probably like the best predictor workout of marathon fitness, in my opinion. Instead of just like running it straight through, we start playing with a little bit of like pace change in the threshold, So it's like, okay, like we know, like if you're gonna run 208, you need to be able to run like, say, 4:55 pace up here in Flagstaff on Lake Mary, your 5 minute pace. So how do we work towards making that, like normal, like you're saying? And so, we'd run 1 mile at say 4:55 pace, and then another mile where you're kind of quote unquote recovering at like 5:10 pace or 5:05 pace, So kind of like where you go and you touch the pace, you try to get the body as comfortable as you can at that pace, and then you back off and you let your body just like get back to its, back under your threshold line, and then you can go again and hit it again. So I think that kind of training can be super helpful in kind of making, yeah, those paces feel more normal. And you just got, at the end of the day, you got to spend a lot of time at these paces, not just at your marathon race pace, but you need to spend a lot of time. Like Rory, we work a lot on his 5K speed, like he, in his build up this race, he broke 4 minutes for the first time in the mile,
Yeah.
And so really important that you not just are hitting on marathon pace, but then you also have, the speed to back that up and to complement that, and then the long runs to be able to cover the distance and have the callousing on the legs. You kind of need all the pieces of the puzzle to come together. So you got to kind of have the complete package, because I think there's a lot of guys who are aerobically strong enough to hit the standard. Like in the US, we only had a couple guys who could get it this go around. I think there's a lot of guys who are strong enough to do it, but they might be missing one of the other pieces, or they might just not have the great opportunity to go and get the time, But yeah, I think Rory's grown a lot in his ability to be able to sustain those paces and mentally not like look down at your watch and freak out about it. You know, you got to look down and be like, this is my new normal pace, and be willing to get comfortable at a pace that previously was not comfortable for you at, you know?
I would add to that, Ryan. One of the things you're talking about normalizing the new pace or the hard pace, like Chad, like this 208 pace. My favorite thing about having done this is that I didn't really do a ton of workouts at 452 per mile or 302 per K. Like, if we broke down every split I ran throughout the block, like I did not run too many 452 miles. Like, and I think the most important takeaway from that is that I think marathon pace is a little overrated. Marathon feel, marathon, like, and the above and below stuff is just as important. So, like, we worked a lot on half marathon fitness. We ran a good half marathon in the build to kind of confirm that we had that piece to the puzzle. And then we just did a lot of like quality long runs that didn't look that sexy on paper, like not a ton of 452 splits, but like touching sub 5 minute pace in a fartlek 2.5 hours into a 2.5 hour long run, right? Like the last 30 minutes, you're over 2 hours on time on feet, and I'm still touching sub 5 minute mile pace up here. So it didn't look like I was like this master of 452 in training and just was like, oh, he was a metronome, and then he turned it on race day. It was more like I knew how to feel that feeling of like, this is marathon effort, I can do this, and also just calloused the legs with above and below pace work.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was listening to I think he's like the performance advisor for EF Education Cycling, and he was saying that like say something like threshold training. He was saying that he thinks that your best way to affect threshold, like from a fitness standpoint, is to work below it and above it. But he's like working at threshold is really just practicing running at threshold pace. And so I tend to kind of agree that I think we can get a little obsessive about running the specific paces, rather than like knowing, and I think it takes a certain amount of confidence to know that you'll be able to run that pace because you're fit enough to run that pace. And you get fit enough to run that pace by, like you're saying, putting in a lot of quality aerobic work and stuff also above your threshold too, or above your marathon pace. Because yeah, I mean, that was crazy. What month was that you broke 4 minutes in the mile?
It was early December, so what, 2 months and like 2 weeks before. So I think it was 10 or 11 weeks out from the marathon, to be exact.
And I think Ryan mentioned that like you guys weren't, it wasn't like you guys were necessarily pinpointing running. Like it was kind of a happenstance thing where like the speed was coming along well, so you took a stab at it. But it wasn't like you guys were going out of your way to try to break 4 minutes for the mile, right?
So Ryan wanted me to do a track race, and he had suggested a 5K because we needed to work on my 5K stuff. And I was like, dude, I really don't have the desire to run a 5K, but we can train for the 5K, touch a little bit of mile speed, and then I'll just jump in a mile because that sounds way more fun and exciting to me. So really, we kind of trained like 5K specific stuff and did a couple things to kind of sharpen up for a mile, and then just took a stab at it because that was more exciting. And it didn't really matter what race I ran 11 weeks out. It was like, what was I doing in training to prepare and get ready before I started doing, you know, the marathon grind.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, breaking 4 minutes for the mile is just a fun accomplishment to have on the list, too. So, just something that's
Yes.
like mo motivates that training that you're going to be doing, anyways.
Yeah, and I mean, I have a lot of fun running fast 200s on the track and 400s, 300s. Like, those things are fun and exciting to me. So it wasn't super hard to get excited about that. But man, 5K, 10K training can be pretty grueling, and I just didn't feel up for that coming off of my marathon in the summer. So I was like, can we just do a mile instead? Kind of get the same spirit, but have the focus be a little different. So
Yeah.
Rory, we don't have a mile on the schedule for your upcoming race, dude. Maybe we should look for one, hey? Well, we're doing a 10K this time. I have a different goal. I have to break I have to break 28 minutes before I retire officially from the track. So that's the exciting. It's a little less exciting than a mile, admittedly. I kind of hate the 10K, but I think that the goal itself is worth chasing. So,
I think you should have the goal of breaking four for your last mile in a 5K. The old Prefontaine. You got to eclipse
just jogging.
three. No, not just jog it. You got to actually, that's what it takes to, who was saying that? That's what it takes to make the final of the world champ. Someone was telling me that. Were you
I
saying that?
told you that. I said
Yeah.
that in the car ride down to Cottonwood the other day, which, hey, I'm not trying to make the final in the Olympic 5000. I'm trying to place well in the Olympic marathon. So at this point, I don't think this matches our goals.
I'm just fishing. I'm just trying to get you excited for a mile again.
I mean the closing miles on races these days are pretty absurd. So Ryan, I think that's a tough thing to do, like we were saying, to jump from marathon training back towards like 5K, 10K work, which I know that's like a big component of your philosophy around marathon training, right? Is to touch on 5K, 10K stuff, so you're taking that back with you into your marathon training. All right, like what are some suggestions on how to do that? How to like come back? Like obviously you probably need to run lower mileage, right? Or drop mileage somehow. Like how do you accommodate 5K, 10K types of efforts? Because every time I try to do it, I struggle getting back into 5K, 10K work, because honestly it's just such a different way of running, different way of training.
Yeah, it's a tricky business for sure, and I'm still learning about how to best do this. I think honestly, like you need enough space between marathons to have the time to be able to work on it. Even on like a 2 marathon a year cycle, it's still like pretty tight. You take your week off, and then a week or two of easy running, and then you're starting to build back into that kind of 5K, 10K training. That can be a little bit, intense and jarring to the systems. The system's not necessarily used to it. But if you have it as a component in training, which it should be, in my opinion, even when you're doing your marathon training, it can be less jarring to the system. So I think part of it depends on how you trained in your previous marathon in terms of how you react to reintroducing 5K, 10K training. And then, the other component's just having enough space. And then I think I've learned to like, try to create, if we have time. Again, this is a little bit of a challenge even for Rory right now. If he does go to the games, we're turning it around where he's running, the Olympic marathon. What's the date of it, Rory? It's in August sometime, like
August 10th.
August 10th. So, we don't have like until the fall to get ready for it. So we had to kind of turn him around pretty quick and get him on the track. And he's like paying his dues on the track right now with the boys kind of a couple months in front of him in terms of training. But he recovers really well. And like I said, it's been a component of his training, but it is, you got to be kind of delicate with it, I think, in how you go about doing it and introducing it in such a way that is the body's able to accept it. And I think that's where it really just kind of comes down to each individual athlete and being willing to listen to your athletes, and like what they're craving, what they're ready for, what they're not ready for. That's where like having an open line of communication with your athletes where they can tell you, hey, like this workout, like the other day I was like had something on the schedule and I was asking him, I was like, do you feel like that's too aggressive? And he's like, yeah, that's too aggressive. And so I was like, okay, well, let's switch that up, so I think that's where, you just need to, the athlete needs to be in tune with their body and what they can handle. And then the coach needs to be able to listen to the athlete and adjust things accordingly. But it's certainly tricky waters when you're trying to make a quick turnaround to 5K, 10K training. But I think if you're, going to see what you can do in the marathon in the long term, you got to keep that speed component there. I learned that through my career. And that's certainly something that I've tried to keep going with my athletes that I'm coaching.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that you do with the 5K, like keeping the 5K type work in there is like, say, like having 200s, like we would do like 10 by 200, two sets pretty often. So you like to kind of keep that speed work throughout so that it's in some sense never a shock to the system to jump back into that stuff.
Yeah, and it's just kind of logical that if you don't do something, you lose it. You see that in the aging process, especially. I think that's why a lot of older athletes struggle with the speed work is because they get far away from it, stop doing it, then you lose it, So, yeah, we try to keep that a part of the program as much as we can. Just the emphasis changes, but it's kind of like, the threshold work's always kind of in there, scattered in there as well, but yeah, what you're focused on and emphasizing kind of changes. But I like those 200s. I got that from Mike Smith. It's one of his kind of workouts that he has a lot of his athletes do, and it's just kind of like easier on the system. It gets the wheels turning, and almost everyone loves 200s, so it's a good kind of introductory distance. Or also too, it's like you're coming out of a big long run or a long threshold or something like that, legs are beat up, but you can almost always get through a set of 200s and come out of it feeling pretty good. So yeah, that one is a good one that I like a lot. And then we've been playing a little bit too with some like track fartlek style stuff, kind of alternating between say a 200 and a 200 float, or a 400 200 float back to a 200, just kind of changing things up that way too. But doing stuff on the track is not a necessity, but usually the quality of those workouts is a little bit higher if athletes do get on the track. But gotta be a little bit careful too, because then you're turning left all the time, things can get unbalanced and tweaked. So sometimes you need to just do it on the road. Like I have one guy right now who has plantar fasciitis, and so tomorrow he's gonna be trying to run some two flat 800s out on the road on Lake Mary because plantar fasciitis doesn't like the turns as much, so you do what you got to do to stay healthy first and foremost.
Yeah, which I did that. I mean, I've had some various issues with lower ankle, hamstring stuff, so I've kind of avoided the track. And it is a funny thing to do, like proper speed workout on the open road. It just feels funny.
You feel like you're flying.
Yeah, well, I think I'm never maybe going as fast as, yeah, it feels like you're going, because yeah, you're just not used to it. So one thing that I want to touch on, I think you guys have like a very interesting like well working coach athlete relationship. And Rory, you're definitely a person who I feel like likes to throw out ideas, likes to be involved with what your training looks like. So how do you guys go about kind of communicating around like what workouts, making adjustments, maybe even Rory throwing out some ideas? Like, how do you guys go about that whole communication process?
You want me to go first here? Or do you want Ryan
Yeah.
to go first here?
Yeah, go
You
for
go,
it,
Rory. I want to hear what you have to say first.
Ryan.
So I can clean it
Okay.
up afterwards.
Yeah, I feel like that's the best way to move about here. I would say the cool thing is yeah, I do absolutely have opinions and ideas, and I'm always thinking about what I think I need to get better. And my mind is very active in the process of like, what do I need? What do I need? What do I need? But my favorite thing is when I think of something and then all of a sudden, like I wait till my training comes and then I'm like, oh, that's what I needed. That's perfect. Like when things actually, you feel like you're in lockstep with like what you feel like you need and what your coach is already giving you. And I think that's also because Ryan knows me pretty well at this point, that it's getting easier for him to predict what I need. And we're on the same page in that regard. But if I ever feel like there's something really specific, he's always open to the idea that I can throw a workout right at him and he might give me that exact workout, or he might chew on it, as he likes to say, and and tweak it or add something to it to make it fit the goal. But I've never felt like my ideas are dumb or not worthy or not being well received. And that's really valuable, I think, because then I have a lot of confidence in what I'm doing, because not only do I trust Ryan, but I know that he trusts me and is listening to all the needs that I may or may not have.
Yeah, I think that was good. And I think on that note of trust, that was one, tweak that Rory and I made recently. Was the one I'd say most contentious issue between us is on volume, right? So like Rory loves volume, and that's great. Like I think there is a time and place for volume, But like rather than like me trying to control his volume all the time, I just kind of gave him rein. I was like, I trust that you're gonna do your easy days right. You're not gonna run on tired legs if you're out there and slogging, you're not just gonna slog through a 90-minute run because you're trying to get 12 miles so that you can hit some number at the end of the week. And because I can trust Rory to do that, and then I just let him dictate his own volume on his easy days. That was kind of a tweak we made. So rather than me prescribing how far he's running on his easy days, I just write easy day and he finds what's right for him on the day. And I think that's the ideal scenario. Like he should be listening to his body, in touch with his body. I don't know how he's going to feel on any given day. I have an idea of how I think he might feel, but he's the one out there running and he's the one out there in his own body. And he should be making the call on how far he's going on these days within, obviously I do like cycles of training, like 5K training cycle. I don't like just doing the same thing over and over again because I don't feel like that works. But everyone does respond different to volume, and so I think Rory's done a good job of knowing his body, knowing he does respond well to volume, but then also within that, like listening to his body and not running more than he should be. And I think that's worked really nicely for us, and developed a good coach athlete relationship that way, where I can just trust him. I know he's not going to do something stupid out there, and so he's going to go find the right amount each day, and he's gonna run it. And I think that's worked super well. So, I think about like successful coach athlete relationships. I think about good communication has to be there, but then also a level of trust, between the coach and the athlete, and it has to go both ways. So, yeah, that's kind of one tweak that we've made that I think has worked really well.
Nice. So say, Rory being a very experienced athlete and also coach himself, how would you address that if you have somebody who's wanting to be more involved with their coaching, but maybe you don't trust them as much, Like,
Right.
is there a process, and maybe you guys even went through a little bit of this of getting to know each other, of establishing trust, but then also maybe a little bit of like coaching somebody. Like I think with some of my athletes, like I'm trying to coach them to make good decisions because they might not make good decisions, right? Like they might go out and overrun all their easy runs if I'm not giving them some guidelines. So how do you balance that with, or how do you figure that out with your athletes, like how to establish that relationship or even the dynamic?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I've had athletes where they weren't listening to me and they were doing secret runs and not telling me about it, and running 3 times a day and doing stupid stuff. And, I tried to work with them and they just kept doing it. And I was like, listen, like I'm here to help you, but you have to let me help you and you have to trust me. And if you don't trust me, then what are we doing? Like, if you just trust yourself and you want to do what you want to do, then you don't need me. Go do what you want to do. And it's fine, And some people are like better off, like just calling their own shots, but I don't know. I've always been under the, my mindset has always been like, learn from someone who's done it before, who's been there before, like it is helpful to have guides in life, no matter what you're trying to take on. So, but I've had athletes, yeah, where I'm just like, okay, like, I don't, you're hurting yourself and I don't want to be a part of you hurting yourself. And so I'm just gonna, we're gonna part ways. It's just not a working relationship. So, I think having boundaries, the coach has to have boundaries that he's comfortable with, and the athlete has to have boundaries that he's comfortable with. And sometimes, those boundaries don't work together and you got to part ways. But ideally, you trust each other, and but the athlete has to let you help them, right? And they have to trust you. And if they don't have that, that's kind of why like I don't go recruiting athletes, because I don't want to convince athletes that they should trust me. Like I want them to trust me because they believe in me, because of what I've done, because of what I've done with my athletes, because of talking to me and starting the relationship out and believing in what we're doing. Like they have to really believe in what we're doing, or else it's not going to work. So I think those components kind of have to be there.
Yeah, nice. So in your guys' early coaching relationship, was there any difficulties like getting into a flow with each other? Was it just like a learning process at all? Maybe Rory, you could speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say no, because like Ryan just said, I went to Ryan, I sought him out because I believed in him. And I had this really strong feeling that that's what I wanted. I wanted someone who'd been where I had been, where I'd wanted to go, and had been in my shoes also, like he'd been an athlete before. And so when I was looking for a new coach, I just left a situation. I knew exactly what kind of thing I wanted. And then when I jumped in with Ryan, I think I had a pretty open mind at first. I was really excited to learn and like do something new. And I think going into that relationship with an open mind allowed me to like learn and also I guess buy in quicker, because I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, I've never done anything like this. Like, oh, Ryan does this. Like, it was just like all these like little nuances that I was like super excited about, because they were just different than what I had done before. And so, yeah, I just felt like that was a big part of why it worked. We had pretty quick success that first season I worked with Ryan. I think I ran a personal best in the half marathon, the 3K, 5K, and marathon, all within 8 months of working with Ryan. So it wasn't like it took a time for us to figure out something to work. Then we had kind of a down season right after that. So like there was this huge peak, and then we kind of went through our roller coasters. I was getting injured and stuff, and we had to learn a new set of rules to play by and stuff. And that's athlete and coach figuring that piece of the puzzle out together.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's one of the most challenging things about running in general is like it's pretty much never like a linear progression, right? Riding those highs and lows. So what do you do when it's not going super well? Like what were some things that you guys did to kind of right the ship, or like how do you deal with that when it's not going super well? Rory.
I think yeah, Rory, you want to start?
Yeah, I could comment on that. I mean, for me specifically, I try to figure out what's wrong first and foremost. Like, why did this happen? You got to kind of go back to like the root cause, because if you don't know why you're in the bad situation you're in, you're going to repeat the mistake again. And I think basically it was like going into certain sessions too tired, or like when I felt tired, just trying to be a hammerhead and get through it, like fighting my body too many times. And now I think I can put my pride aside and be in those same feelings and like be like, no, I just need to adjust today. Like today's not the day to push those buttons. And athletes are very type A, very driven. And I think I coach a handful of athletes, and I've been that athlete where if it's on the paper, I'm going to try to do it, and I'm going to try to do it, come hell or high water. And now I think I've come to this place where I can be flexible with it. And I think Ryan goes into workouts already with that mindset, like, hey, I wrote this down, but like that doesn't mean that's what we're doing. We can adjust after the warm up, after a set, after halfway through, three-fourths through, we can pull the plug with one rep to go. All those things are negotiable. Like this is just the ideal starting point.
Yeah, I think too, like on that note, when Rory's talking about like figuring out what the problem is too. I was thinking about Rory, like you start working with Jesse, right? And he started helping you with some like strength stuff that like really seemed to really help things a lot too. So I think sometimes, they see the athlete out there running, and you're like, okay, that's the guy doing it, and he's got a whole team of people behind him. But it's not just the coach, it's the person doing the body work, and it's the person helping with the strength program, and it's all the stuff coming together. Because sometimes it's just like, dude, like you just have an injury or something that's off, you become imbalanced as an athlete, and you need someone to help right the ship. And it's not always the coach that can do that. You know, sometimes you need an outside perspective, outside input, someone who can come alongside the athlete and kind of help get the body moving correctly again and balanced again. And then everything starts to work again, you know, or maybe it's a nutritionist who comes in and be like, hey, yeah, your iron is super low. If you would get your iron right, you'd be running great, you know? So it's, you know, the training is, I think, a little bit of a smaller component than we often make it out to be. Like the body needs to be in a state where it can absorb the load, you know? So that's another kind of thing to add in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said this before, like that Rory does a good job of taking care of all the other details, right? And I think that's something that, like, lower level athletes, I think sometimes people sign up for coaching and think that, like, they get a training plan and that's this, like you're saying, the significant portion, that's the map to success. But it's like so contingent on your recovery and all those other aspects. So Rory, what How do you think about the detail work and like what things do you put a lot of emphasis on or have found very helpful?
Good question. This is something that's changed throughout my career based on my experience and where I'm at and what I feel is lacking. Like when I was injured last spring, about a year ago, actually, it was like my body is not balanced. So now we need to get in the weight room and find balance and go to yoga and do all these little things. But that doesn't stay with me forever. Like I don't do that exact same thing. Once I've found balance again, the emphasis has to be placed on now what gives me the best chance to get back to training at a very, very high level. And I'd say the constant here, and it's not like anything specific. I don't have like some crazy rule I live by or like rigid dietary confinements that I live in, but like I just eat a lot. Like I was telling Chad, I always be snacking. You know, I'm having a protein cookie right now. I think it's super, super important to avoid under fueling. I take great pride in the fact that so far throughout my career, I've avoided the big injury. I might get the small one, the flare up. You know, those things are going to happen. But where you get into a really dangerous cycle is when you are at a calorie deficit for a very long time. So I just keep it super simple and just tell myself like just don't get in that hole. Never get, because then you gotta climb out. And sometimes it's a lot harder to climb out than you may think. So I take that as serious as anything. And then also just being pretty routine. I think I have a pretty stable foundation around me, like with my family, with my social life, like with my personal life, all those things. Like it's just like just trying to keep everything so that it complements what I'm trying to do in training. And some people's lifestyles are way better suited for that. Obviously, I'm in a very luxurious situation where training is my number one priority, but I know a lot of people that are, you know, professionals in the workforce where their job maybe does still sit in a way that they can train at a super high level and hit all these things. And that's, you got to find your balance because you can't take on more than you can, I guess, absorb, like Ryan said. And usually that comes down to how much time do you have to devote to the things outside of just the training.
Yeah, that's so great. I mean, I think that's, I heard, I think Mike Smith say something about that, that like, if an athlete essentially isn't happy, like if they don't have their other things in their life in order, that like you'll be baffled by the results because they just won't be able to pull it together. And I think sometimes we don't put enough emphasis on all the other factors, right, around an athlete. So that's cool to hear you say that. And so a follow-up question is just, how do you view running in terms of like being a component of your life? Like what role does it play for you?
Good question again. It's always been like my outlet and my passion. So, you know, life has its ups and downs, but I've always kind of used running as just like this place of joy and place of me time, kind of escape. I genuinely like going for runs. Like I don't like not running. Like I breaks are miserable for me. I'm like the least happy day four of a break. First 3 days, it's nice. You know, you do something different, but then I'm craving that feeling that I get running. And even when I don't run a lot, like a 30-minute easy run just doesn't do it for me. You know what I mean? Like, running is just like that time where like I can be alone, away with my thoughts, kind of digest other things in my life. I use it as like thinking time, me time. I run alone a lot, and I think that that's really beneficial for me. So yeah, it's a big part, but it's not everything. Like I think now as I've grown up, what it's become is it's maybe a highlight of my day, but then once I get done with that, it's gone. Like I'm not thinking about running when I'm not running is the goal. I think compartmentalizing my lifestyle has helped a lot, and I think it's easier to do that when you have two little kids, you know, and a lot of responsibility, because then you kind of have you're forced to think about other things. Like when I'm playing with Jace before dinner, because I'm trying to keep him out of the kitchen so he doesn't create a ruckus out there. Like I'm not thinking about like tomorrow's run. I'm thinking about entertaining my kid for the next hour until it's time to put him down for bed or eat dinner. You know, it's just it the life kind of just gets in the way of running in a positive way.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, because what I mean, it's pretty amazing. Like, I think you might think that having kids would be disruptive to a good training program, right? Maybe limit some, you know, might affect sleep or whatnot. How have you viewed like having kids and the effect that it's just had on running and just life in general?
Well, motivation wise, like I make a living running, and I want to set up my family in a positive way and provide for them. So I have a lot of purpose behind everything I'm doing. And Ryan and I chatted after Seville. I think, you know, we're talking about that race, and Ryan, you asked Ryan, like, did you think you could do it? And he's like, I thought he could do it, but I thought it'd be tight. And I don't think I would have done it if I didn't feel an immense amount of pressure to do it. Like I just felt like I had to do it. It was like do or die, you know, back against the wall. Like I need to do this for so many reasons, and one of those reasons is my family, right? Like I want to put them in a great position. I want to do this for them. They sacrifice for my selfish endeavors all the time. So it's like I got to make it worth it. It was like it's got to, like, everything I've done has to be worth it, because if it's not, then I've just been wasting their time, their energy, like taking time things away from them, because there is sacrifice on their end, I think, in the fact that, like, sometimes I am a little less aware or energetic when I would love to, you know, go play soccer outside with Jays or something. It's like, but sometimes I'm tired, and I don't want to do that because I've been training really hard. And so it's got to all come and be worth it at the end of the day. And that's something that I think the family creates a positive pressure on my life.
That's awesome. Well, we are running out of time once again. So I thought maybe we'd wrap it up. If you guys have a fun story about each other, and we'll go each one if you if we can do or not do this. Ryan, do you have any? We'll start with Ryan. Ryan, do you have any funny Rory stories that you'd like to share?
Yeah, I mean, Rory knows which one I'm gonna say.
I don't.
You were just talking about it the other day at the track. It was we were out at the track, and you know, we were getting ready for like, it's like 5K or 10K workout. I don't remember what it was. And Rory's telling me all about this workout, this 5K, same system we're trying to hit. He's all excited about this workout. He's telling me all about it. And I was like, dude, that's a freaking great workout. I was like, that's perfect for today. I was like, let's do it. And then Rory's eyes get all big. It's, you know, Rory likes to like know what's co he's gotten better at this, and I like to stretch him in this area, but he likes to know what's coming down. He likes to mentally prepare for it. He likes to have all his ducks in a row, you know. So I like to throw a little curveballs every once in a while just to stretch him, because I know that I've seen him respond well to this time and time again. Like one of my favorite attributes of Rory is I've seen him evolve and change, and his ability to grow and be coachable and to listen and to get better. Like he's a better person and athlete now than he was when we first started working together. And that's not because of me, it's because of his ability to be able to grow and listen and be aware of things, you know? And that's one of the ways actually he balances me out really well too, is like he loves to learn about the sport. He loves to, you know, look into the Norwegian training model, and then now he's super into the Japanese training model. And I'm like, this is great. So I don't have time to do all the research, but Rory will freaking dive super deep into it, and then he can just tell me everything he learned, and then we can, you know, try some things out that might be interesting that he learns from that, you know. So he balances me out well that way. But anyways, going back to the workout, so I'm like, all right, dude, let's do the workout. I was like, that's a freaking sweet workout. And his eyes come up. He's like, dude, oh, no, not today. Today's not here. And I was like, why not? And he's like, it's just I'm not prepared. I'm like, what do you need to do to prepare? I was like, just go do the workout. And so we ended up doing the workout, but it was just a funny to me, I'll just never forget the look in his eyes when I told him, I was like, let's do your workout. Like, I love it. Let's do it. And he was just like so surprised by that. It looked like someone just like shattered his world. It was pretty funny.
I will comment that I don't believe it was the same type of workout. I think I had 200s and 300s,
No.
which is a lot more
No.
palatable than we ended
No.
up doing 800s, and I just
Do
didn't feel
not.
physically ready to do that long of an interval.
Do not believe that. Disregard that last comment.
It was like a B workout turned into an A workout, and that's why my earth was shattered. I'll stand by
No.
that, but.
No, incorrect. We need an outside source to verify this.
Mitch was there, so we can ask him for comment later, but all right. I'll counter with a quick story. Just like I think this just embodies what Ryan's idea of an adventure is versus like what a normal person's idea of an adventure is after my marathon in 2022, I did a Toronto marathon in the fall. And as part of my break, this was when Ryan was really, he still is really into it, so it doesn't really change, but mountain adventures is what he was calling them. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do one on my break with you. And like, there's not a lot of details that go into these things, right? Like, it's like a meeting place and a time, maybe. Like, that's about it. And so he's like, bring food. And just not a lot of follow-up, such like I was like, well, what time will I be home? And he's like, don't have a plan. Like, plan nothing. I was like, well, I
It's
gotta
your
tell
own,
Jill.
it's like your own individual Barclays marathon.
Yeah, it is very much like that. So I was like, well, like, how long are we going? Like, where are we going? Like, I have all of these follow-up because I want to know, like, similar to what the workout story was, is it's like there's a lot of unknown here. How do I prepare for this? Like, what do I bring? What do I wear? Like, what do I tell Jill because Jill's not accustomed to me leaving and not hearing from me for 7 or 8 hours. And I think this specific occasion was solid. It wasn't a catastrophic experience. We met at a certain time. I was probably a little bit underprepared in terms of like what to wear. We ended up going again and writing some of my mistakes. But the bottom line is like this spontaneous, like unplanned adventure side of Ryan, which is kind of like I think how he views a lot of things in life, is just like you got to kind of break it down and just have some fun with it. It was really hard for me to understand what he meant when he said, look, I thought we were gonna go walk in the woods for a couple hours, but it ended up being a whole day excursion with Sayer losing his phone on the side of a mountain and then going back at night and finding it later that night
My
in the like
gosh.
off trail, just all this crazy stuff. But anyways, that to me is a really funny embodiment of the child that is Ryan Hall.
That's Oh
Awesome.
yeah. Chad knows all about this. Chad, tell the people all about a true haul. What do we call them? Haul hike?
Yeah. Well, so the
The
first time
rules of a
that,
haul hike.
yeah, the first time my girlfriend and I went on a hike together. It was kind of like that, where it's like we went out and I was like, well, let's go for a short hike. And then I'd never been to this trail. It happens to me going to the top of this mountain. I'm like, well, let's keep going until we get to the top of a mountain. And it ends up being something crazy, like 3,500 feet. And it's like gnarly steep. We don't have any food or water. And she's also likes to plan, like really likes to plan. And so she called it a whole hike because I think it took us like 6 hours. And yeah, it's the whole way to just like wing it, maybe be prepared, maybe not. Just kind of go have a day out.
Yeah, you gotta end in the dark with no lights coming down by moonlight. That's like the way you do it in the mountains.
Good old supper fest.
That's right.
Well, Rory, thanks for coming on the podcast, man. We'll definitely, I think, have you back on at some point here. I mean, I'm curious to hear all your research on Japanese training and Norwegian training model and all that. So maybe we'll do a little training chat at some point.
Yeah, I'd love that. So I'm very curious about what other people are doing to be successful.